by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We are grass make dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We're going to be covering two events this week. We're going to start off with the conclusion of the government closed down. And President Trump did reach an agreement with congressional leaders. And we're going to start off and play his speech that he gave Friday in the Rose Garden about, you know, opening it, but reopening the government and the agreement that they finally came to with congressional leadership. Here we go now with President Trump.
Thank you very much, my fellow Americans. I am very proud to announce today that we have reached a deal to end the shutdown and reopen the federal government. As everyone knows, I have a very powerful alternative, but I didn't want to use it at this time. Hopefully it will be unnecessary. I want to thank all of the incredible federal workers and their amazing families who have shown such extraordinary devotion in the face of this recent hardship. You are fantastic people. You are incredible patriots. Many of you have suffered far greater than anyone but your families would know or understand. And not only did you not complain, but in many cases you encouraged me to keep going because you care so much about our country and about its border security. Again, I thank you. All Americans, I thank you. You are very, very special people. I am so proud that you are citizens of our country. When I say make America great again, it could never be done without you. Great people. In a short while, I will sign a bill to open our government for 3 weeks until February 15th. I will make sure that all employees receive their back pay very quickly or as soon as possible. It'll happen fast. I am asking Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to put this proposal on the floor immediately. After 36 days of spirited debate and dialogue, I have seen and heard from enough Democrats and Republicans that they are willing to put partisanship aside, I think, and put the security of the American people first. I do believe they're going to do that. They have said they are for complete border security, and they have finally and fully acknowledged that having barriers, fencing, or walls, or whatever you want to call it, will be an important part of the solution. A bipartisan conference committee of House and Senate lawmakers and leaders will immediately begin reviewing the requests of our Homeland Security experts, and experts they are, and also law enforcement professionals who have worked with us so closely. We want to thank Border Patrol, ICE, and all law enforcement. Been incredible. Based on operational guidance from the experts in the field, they will put together a Homeland Security package for me to shortly sign into law. Over the next 21 days, I expect that both Democrats and Republicans will operate in good faith. This is an opportunity for all parties to work together for the benefit of our whole beautiful, wonderful nation. If we make a fair deal, the American people will be proud of their government for proving that we can put country before party. We can show all Americans and people all around the world that both political parties are united when it comes to protecting our country and protecting our people. Many disagree, but I really feel that working with Democrats and Republicans, we can make a truly great and secure deal happen for everyone. Walls should not be controversial. Our country has built 654 miles of barrier over the last 15 years, and every career Border Patrol agent I have spoken with has told me that walls work. They do work. No matter where you go, they work. Israel built a wall, 99.9% successful. Won't be any different for us. They keep criminals out. They save good people from attempting a very dangerous journey from other countries, thousands of miles, because they think they have a glimmer of hope of coming through. With a wall, they don't have that hope. They keep drugs out, and they dramatically increase efficiency by allowing us to patrol far larger areas with far fewer people. It's just common sense. Walls work. That's why most of the Democrats in Congress have voted in the past for bills that include walls and physical barriers and very powerful fences. The walls we are building are not medieval walls. They are smart walls designed to meet the needs of frontline border agents and are operationally effective. These barriers are made of steel, have see-through visibility, which is very important, and are equipped with sensors, monitors, and cutting-edge technology, including state-of-the-art drones. We do not need 2,000 miles of concrete wall from sea to shiny sea. We never did. We never proposed that. We never wanted that, because we have barriers at the border where natural structures are as good as anything that we can build. They're already there. They've been there for millions of years. Our proposed structures will be in predetermined high-risk locations that have been specifically identified by the Border Patrol to stop illicit flows of people and drugs. No border security plan can ever work without a physical barrier. Just doesn't happen. At the same time, we need to increase drug detection technology and manpower to modernize our ports of entry, which are obsolete. The equipment's obsolete. They're old. They're tired. This is something we have all come to agree on and will allow for quicker and safer commerce. These critical investments will improve and facilitate legal trade and travel through our lawful ports of entry. Our plan also includes desperately needed humanitarian assistance for those being exploited and abused by coyotes, smugglers, and the dangerous journey north. The requests we have put before Congress are vital to ending the humanitarian and security crisis on our southern border. Absolutely vital. Will not work without it. This crisis threatens the safety of our country and thousands of American lives. Criminal cartels, narco-terrorists, transnational gangs like MS-13, and human traffickers are brazenly violating U.S. laws and terrorizing innocent communities. human traffickers. The victims are women and children. Maybe to a lesser extent, believe it or not, children. Women are tied up, they're bound, duct tape put around their faces, around their mouths. In many cases, they can't even breathe. They're put in the backs of cars or vans or trucks. They don't go through your port of entry. They make a right turn going very quickly. They go into the desert areas or whatever areas you can look at. And as soon as there's no protection, they make a left or a right into the United States of America. There's nobody to catch them. There's nobody to find them. They can't come through the port, because if they come through the port, people will see four women sitting in a van with tape around their face and around their mouth. Can't have that. And that problem, because of the Internet, is the biggest problem. It's never been like this before, that you can imagine. It's at the worst level, human trafficking, in the history of the world. This is not a United States problem. This is a world problem. But they come through areas where they have no protection, where they have no steel barriers, where they have no walls. And we can stop almost 100% of that. The profits reaped by these murderous organizations are used to fund their malign and destabilizing conduct throughout this hemisphere. Last year alone, ICE officers removed 10,000 known or suspected gang members like MS-13 and members as bad as them. Horrible people. Tough, mean, sadistic. In the last 2 years, ICE officers arrested a total of 266,000 criminal aliens inside of the United States, including those charged or convicted of nearly 100,000 assaults, 30,000 sex crimes, and 4,000 homicides, or, as you would call them, violent, vicious killings. Can be stopped. Vast quantities of lethal drugs, including meth, fentanyl, heroin, and cocaine, are smuggled across our southern border and into U.S. schools and communities. Drugs kill much more than 70,000 Americans a year and cost our society in excess of $700 billion. The sheer volume of illegal immigration has overwhelmed federal authorities and stretched our immigration system beyond the breaking point. Nearly 50 migrants a day are being referred for medical assistance. They are very, very sick, making this a health crisis as well. It's a very big health crisis. People have no idea how big it is unless you're there. Our backlog in the immigration courts is now far greater than the 800,000 cases that you've been hearing about over the last couple of years. Think of that, though. 800,000 cases, because our laws are obsolete. So obsolete. They're the laughing stock all over the world. Our immigration laws, all over the world, they've been there for a long time, are the laughing stock all over the world. We do not have the necessary space or resources to detain, house, vet, screen, and safely process this tremendous influx of people. In short, we do not have control over who is entering our country, where they come from, who they are, why they are coming. The result for many years is a colossal danger to public safety. We're going to straighten it out. It's not hard. It's easy if given the resources. Last month was the third straight month in a row with 60,000 apprehensions on our southern border. Think of that. We apprehended 60,000 people. That's like a stadium full of people, a big stadium. There are many criminals being apprehended, but vast numbers are coming because our economy is so strong. We have the strongest economy now in the entire world. You see what's happening. We have nowhere left to house them and no way to promptly remote them. We can't get them out because our laws are so obsolete, so antiquated, and so bad. Without new resources from Congress, we will be forced to release these people into communities, something we don't want to do, called catch and release. You catch them. Even if they're criminals, you then release them. And you can't release them from where they came, so they go into our country and end up in places you would least suspect. And we do as little releasing as possible, but they're coming by the hundreds of thousands. I have had zero Democrat lawmakers volunteer to have them released into their districts or states. And I think they know that. And that's what we're going to be discussing over the next 3 weeks. The painful reality is that the tremendous economic and financial burdens of illegal immigration fall on the shoulders of low-income Americans, including millions of wonderful, patriotic, law-abiding immigrants who enrich our nation. As Commander-in-Chief, my highest priority is the defense of our great country. We cannot surrender operational control over the nation's borders to foreign cartels, traffickers, and smugglers. We want future Americans to come to our country legally and through a system based on merit. We need people to come to our country. We have great companies moving back into the United States. And we have the lowest employment and the best employment numbers that we've ever had. There are more people working today in the United States than have ever worked in our country. We need people to come in to help us on the farms and with all of these great companies that are moving back. Finally, they're moving back. People said it couldn't happen. It's happening. And we want them to enjoy the blessings of safety and liberty and the rule of law. We cannot protect and deliver these blessings without a strong and secure border. I believe that crime in this country can go down by a massive percentage if we have great security on our southern border. I believe drugs, large percentages of which come through the southern border, will be cut by a number that nobody will believe. So let me be very clear. We really have no choice but to build a powerful wall or steel barrier. If we don't get a fair deal from Congress, the government will either shut down on February 15th again, or I will use the powers afforded to me under the laws and the Constitution of the United States to address this emergency. We will have great security. And I want to thank you all very much. Thank you very much.
The president was very gracious in his, you say, his agreement with congressional leaders. It was considered a defeat because he was holding off for the wall. But what Chuck Schumer had to say is coming up next, and then I'll make some concluding remarks and comments about what I think is going on behind the scenes. But anyway, this is what Chuck Schumer said, and it wasn't very nice at all.
The longest shutdown in American history will finally end today. The president has agreed to our request to open the government and then debate border security, which is great news for 800,000 federal workers and millions of Americans who depend on government services. As Democrats have said all along, the solution to this impasse was separate funding for the government and then go over our disagreements from border security. Separate the funding of government from the discussion on border security, and that's what we got. And Democrats in the Senate and in the House were united behind this position throughout the shutdown, and ultimately this agreement endorses our position. It reopens the government without preconditions, gives Democrats and Republicans an opportunity to discuss border security without holding hundreds of thousands of American workers hostage. We expect the continuing resolution to clear the Senate and clear the House this afternoon and be signed by the President today. And before I go on, I think on both of us, but we want to thank all the federal workers from the bottom of our hearts. They've worked so selflessly this past month without pay, showing up to do a job they knew was important, but for which they weren't fairly compensated. The workers showed up despite the callous indifference of the administration, who treated them as hostages, who treated them as pawns, who belittled their financial strain. Our dedicated public servants should never, never have to go through this again. We will do everything we can to make sure they won't have to. And this past month has proven just how vital government services are to the American people, whether it's our food safety, our airports, our national parks, our economy, our national security, and so much else. The American people do not like it when you throw a wrench into the lives of government workers over an unrelated political dispute. Working people throughout America empathized with the federal workers and were aghast at what the president was doing to them.
He made allegations that President Trump was holding them hostage, and we're aghast, he said there at the end, at what the president was doing to these federal employees, many of which were in support of him in strengthening security along the wall. And we know the Democrats want to just bring in as many people as they can, put them on the Democratic rolls, on the party rolls, and get them to vote them in and to win, you know, the elections that they have lined up in the future. So, and they're not really caring much about the border security, but the president is, it struck this agreement. It's only 3 weeks, a little less than 3 weeks to go before he can say, hey, do we have an agreement or not? Or I go the emergency route, see. But I think in the conference committee, he'll enter in to that, those negotiations, some money for the barricades or whatever you want to say, retaining structures or whatever you want to call them at this time. And I think that's where he'll get his wall, so to speak. Now, coming up next, we're going to be talking something. Right now, there's the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. It's just concluded yesterday. And we're going to be playing some clips from there. We're going to start off with Secretary of State Pompeo, his opening speech. We're not going to be playing the questions and answer part of it, but we're going to be playing the speech that he gave from me. They had to bring him in on a Skype connection because when this closing down of the government started, it did interfere somewhat with a delegation, the United States delegation, and Trump was going to go to the World Economic Forum also. But anyway, here we have with Pompeo and his speech from a Skype connection over a remote connection. Here we go now with Secretary of State Pompeo.
Good morning. And thank you, Borge, for your kind introduction. We're not here in Washington, D.C. in memorial to my back. So while I'm not here in person, I at least feel like I'm in Davos with the weather. You know, it's interesting times that we live in. Over the past few years, all around the world, voters have tuned out politicians and political alliances that they thought weren't representing their interests. A few examples of new directions that people have taken. Brexit, the election of President Macron in France, the rise of the Five-Star Movement in Italy, Mahathir's comeback in Malaysia, and of course, Borges, as you referenced, the election of President Donald Trump. In Ohio, Rio de Janeiro, and in Rome, people are asking questions that haven't been asked or at least haven't been taken seriously in an awfully long time. Is economic globalization really good for me? Are political leaders adequately protecting us from threats like terrorism? Are they working to secure our national interests abroad? You all know this. New winds are blowing across the world. The central question is this. Do they signal fair weather or foreshadow a storm? Is this pattern of disruption a force for good or not? I'd argue that this disruption is a positive development. We are embracing time-tested truths. Truths like this. Nations matter. No international body can stand up for a people as well as their own leaders can. Strong borders are key to strong nations. This is how we keep our people safe and protect our sovereignty. Sturdy alliances built on key principles are key to shared security. We need all nations to contribute to security imperatives. President Trump also knows that economic security is national security. Robust defenses aren't possible without healthy economies to undergird them. I'll talk about this for a minute. It's why pro-growth policies matter so much. I'll spend a little time on this, and I'm confident that Secretary Mnuchin will understand if I step on his turf just a little bit here this morning. President Trump's campaign slogan, Make America Great Again, was a call to return America to the principles that have made us the most prosperous nation in world history. It was a rejection of trade arrangements that discounted the interests of American workers. It was a rejection of red tape, which constricted entrepreneurs here in America. This is the lifeblood of our economy. It was a rejection of all high taxes that tell American families that government knows how to spend their money better than those families do. And perhaps more than anything, President Trump's election was a rejection of low expectations. I remember the mantra, I'm sure many of you do, the idea that 2% was the new normal for economic growth. Well, so much for that. Today, thanks to President Trump's pro-growth policies, our real GDP growth here in America has exceeded 3%. Over each of the last four quarters. And that's not all. Wage growth is up. This matters to hardworking Americans. Job openings outnumber the number of unemployed for the first time on record. The women's unemployment rate recently reached its lowest rate in 65 years. Manufacturing, that's what I did before I entered politics, added 284,000 jobs in 2018, the most since 1997. It was said this couldn't be done. Small business optimism is at a record high. There's more to that story. But the important point is this. The unleashing of animal spirits has allowed our economy to grow even as the global slowdown looms. This economic blueprint, low taxes, streamlined regulations, and trade reform can work for you and your countries as well. The time is now to adopt these policies. I remember President Reagan's maximum, peace through strength. This wasn't exclusively military strength. It was the strength created by a free and robust economy that not only creates wealth, but also freedom. As you all know, we face many new threats. Some of them not so new. They range from North Korea's nuclear program, to Iran's foreign adventurism, to China's state-centered economic model, its belligerence toward its neighbors, and its embraces of a totalitarian state at home. Radical Islamic terrorism remains a persistent threat that we will continue to fight together. In all of these areas, we're making progress, but none of this progress could have happened without beautiful coalitions in which America has played a central role. Collectively, we've exerted maximum pressure on North Korea, and that pressure has gotten Kim to the negotiating table. the United Nations did amazing work, acting as the center of gravity for sanctions that built out this global coalition. We've also assembled a global coalition of nations to confront Iran and support the aspirations of the Iranian people. And we're rebalancing the relationship with China alongside partner nations in Asia and all around the world. It should not go unnoticed that we've also defeated the ISIS caliphate in Syria and Iraq, alongside more than six dozen nations in the global coalition to defeat ISIS. There's a lot more work to do, and with your help, I know we'll achieve it. The United States looks forward to partnering with you to take on the challenges of our time. And Borga, I'm now looking forward to our conversation today. Thank you all very much for the opportunity to make these remarks.
One thing about Trump is he's telling them out there where he's coming from. And basically, he's at odds with the New World Order that most of these people at Davos are for totally this New World Order. They're the total creme de la creme of the corporations. They've got Lagarde is there from the IMF, and they've got the World Bank there and all these other leaders and so forth. And they don't like Trump. They've said several comments on some of the panel discussions and everything else that were derogatory of Trump, you know, creating disruptions and unsureness, you know, about what's going on and nobody knows what he's going to do and so forth. And so they've been going back and forth like that. This first clip from Davos is going to be a very, very insightful panel discussion led by Bartiromola from Fox News Network. And she's quite a distinguished interviewer. And anyway, she's going to be leading this. And it's going to be on global risk, okay? And it's got a Chinese bank official in it, UBS there, and some other people chime in. So take a listen here, and then I'll conclude a little bit with who said what at the end and straighten it out for you. But we've got several different people that chime in that are world financial experts, but we have a Chinese perspective also about risk that's very important. So listen to this very carefully, and here we go right now.
Ray, you've been in China for 30 years. You've been visiting there for 30 years. Axel, your firm just announced you now own a financial institution that you own 51% of. Is that right?
Yes, we were the first bank that was offered a 51% stake in a joint venture, and we've executed that in December, and we now are the majority owner. We already had management control, and we're now free to increase that stake further. I think eventually, as we invest in China, and since our major partners are the municipalities of Beijing and Shanghai, there's likely going to happen some dilution of our partners, and we're looking into ways of raising capital also locally. So there is some welcome discussion between, you know, the Chinese authorities, not just with Hong Kong on the Shanghai-Hong Kong Bond Connect, but also there was an ongoing discussion with London. I know that Dr. Fan is talking to the Swiss authorities. So the more we can connect stock markets, the more we can actually be super connectors as international financial institutions to bring international investors into the Chinese economy and to help Chinese investors invest in the rest of the world. And it's absolutely right what our Chinese colleagues have said. The Chinese economy needs competition. And they're working, I think, on three legs of that. First is state-owned enterprise reform. And I think that is very important. And we've all gone through that in Europe in the 90s. Of having former official sector conglomerates move to the private sector. The second one is competition between state-owned enterprises and private enterprises in China. And the third one is, and the authorities so far have been more cautious, opening up the Chinese economy for international competition, because that will really be a major contribution to increasing the competitiveness of companies. And of course, we as international experienced investors can help in that process. And actually can help both Chinese investors internationally and international investors in China. And just to give you an example, banks like UBS, we have a 24% share on the northbound traffic of the A-share market in the Hong Kong Shanghai Stock Connect. So we're kind of the go-to bank for a quarter of the investors into mainland China internationally. Our market share for Chinese investors southbound is below 1%. We're not the go-to bank for international investments for Chinese citizens. And as we're granted majority rights, as we're investing in our business, we just doubled our headcount in China over the last few years, we will become a major go-to partner also for Chinese investors in the global economy. But that will happen at a more measured pace because there is some concern in China that this will impact on the exchange rate. So the opening up process is more controlled, but it's happening. You know, don't mistake speed for direction. The direction is very clear. The speed, I think, has been increased recently. Actually, was just in China in the first weekend.
Yeah.
The constructive dialogues we had with Chinese authority is really on a totally different page today than it was a few years ago. So I'm very confident about this process.
Let's not forget, out of the top 20 banks in the world, the top five are Chinese. Ray.
Well, you mentioned I've been there 30 years and I've watched it evolve. And I think there are two types of things that are going on. Let's call them the short term and the long term, right? As I say, productivity is the big thing in the long term, and that's the real big thing. And then you have the short term debt cycles, and you have the short term things. So the two things that are happening short term is that you're having a deleveraging that you so articulately dealt with. There was an overleveraging, and there was a development of the financial markets. When I, not long ago, it was really 5 or 6 years ago, five major banks loaned money to state-owned enterprises, and the money was clogged at the top. Then there was the development of the shadow banking system and the liberalization of that, and then now put into place regulation. Whenever you're having a deleveraging, that is something that makes the country healthier because you're deleveraging, but it has a short-term effect, but it has a long-term positive. So there's the deleveraging happening. It's a short-term thing. And then there's the trade issues associated with that, which is also a short-term thing. But if you take productivity growth, if you take the approach, and I think it really has to be admired as, you know, Chinese characteristics as it's described. You know, it's a certain top-down, it's a cultural challenge for the West. But there's a top-down way of setting a mission for a 2025 plan or a plan and working those things in a top-down way with unique resources available that has produced in the time that I've been there, you know, an increase of 20 times in incomes. The movement of, it used to be the below poverty level, it's 88% of the population was below poverty level. Today it's less than 1%. There is an ability to produce productivity, but it's a culture clash with the West. Because in some ways, because there, as one of the leaders described it to me, the United States is a country of individualists. An individual is working that up. China is more of a country of that is an extension of the model of the family. He described. He said, "There's the word." Country in China represents state family. And if you go back to Confucianism and how it is run top down, and that is where there's an element of a culture clash. At the same time, when you look at that productivity and the policies and things, it's a very effective place. So I would say it's important to distinguish the short-term influences from the longer-term productivity influences and then recognize that we're now in a world where there is a competition and that can mean conflict in different dimensions between the two countries. That means I think the trade issue is a manageable issue. I think the way of being issue is a challenging issue because you can't expect, Americans can't expect, Chinese to operate in a way that is different from that or vice versa. So I think that's the bigger, longer-term issue. But I think you'd have to be very optimistic when you think of even a 5 or 6% growth rate and what that's going to mean and what the world will look like in 10 or 20 years. It'll be quite a different world in which China's going to be, I think, a lot stronger. So I think that's the picture. Let's not confuse the short term with that bigger picture, evolutionary picture.
Well, what about the picture of debt? I mean, how worried should we be about debt? Particularly, I mean, the U.S. has to sell debt. China, obviously one of the biggest, most significant holders of the U.S.'s debt. Are any of these issues, Dr. Fang, in terms of the trade spat, in terms of slowing growth in China? Are they impacting capital flows?
You know, China will continue to be a what we call a saving surplus country for some time. Although the saving is kind of declining, but it will be a saving surplus country. So we have to invest abroad, and you know, the U.S. government bond market turns out to be a good place to invest. So I don't think China will, you know, in any way significantly reduce its investment into the U.S. Government bond market. But on the other hand, in terms of capital flow, you know, we do open up. We want more companies, you know, from different sectors to come into China. So that should increase capital inflows. We want to increase, you know, both ways. And I want to, Maria, I want to, you know, add one point to what Ray Dalio just said about the cultural shock. Right? China does have sort of a different approach to economic management. And I think in this world, perhaps we should, you know, learn from each other a little bit. And I want to give you one example about how we manage our financial risk. Over the last 40 years, you know, China hasn't had a very significant financial crisis, for example. And that's very rare among the developing world. And I used to work for the World Bank, and, you know, we have financial crisis in the developing countries a lot. And how China has been able to avoid financial crisis, right, in the last 40 years? Well, we have a very kind of top-down approach to financial risk management, and that is the central government constantly is in touch with the financial sector, you know, gets information from the financial sector in a timely manner. And if there's any risk accumulating in the system, the government, you know, will step in and order the risk to be reduced. Now, of course, sometimes we will still miss something, right? So occasionally we have certain financial jitteries in the market. But once we have that financial jittery, you know, our system is able to react to these jitteries in a very quick way, and we move quickly to contain the risk so that the risk does not spread into the entire system and it does not create panic in the system. And then as the economy grows, right, the risk, you know, is diluted going forward. So that's how we have been able to grow our economy by so much and grow the financial system by so much without, you know, incurring a major financial risk. So there's some lesson there, I think, that, you know, the rest of the world perhaps should take a look at.
I think there's, if I may, there's also a point of no return in this whole thing about opening up for China, because you have to look at China's weight in the global economy has really increased massively. China is bordering on to, you know, at least 20% weight in the global economy. If you look at exports, if you look at global growth, still today, most of the growth that we see globally is generated by China's inclusion into the world economy. Now, that is reflected by now putting China a lot more into portfolios, because you can't just have a big part of the global economy be Chinese and investors completely have zero exposure to that growth in their portfolio. So China gets inclusions into indices like the MSCI in the equity indices or in the bond indices like the Bloomberg Index. Our estimate is over the next quarters, there will be $250 billion of capital inflows into China, basically just by this 4% weight that China will get. Now, so far, Ray's absolutely right. China debt is not a problem because it's largely domestically held. Domestic policies and redistribution of that debt can easily be engineered by policymakers. International investors, if they invest in China debt or equity, they want different standards. They want accounting standards. They want very clear, solid products to invest in. So what is happening is that will raise the standards and the bars for equity markets in China, because you need to bring international investors in, and you also need to allow, because you just don't want a big inflow into the Chinese economy that puts upward pressure on the exchange rate, you need to open up in sync international investments for your citizens to invest in the rest of the world, so you create capital outflows. So in the future, the whole debate about QFI and QDI quotas will be a lot more interlinked, because, you know, large banks like us who compete at the top level for Chinese clients We'll have to do both. Only if our action is not just one-sided by bringing international capital in, but also having Chinese invest abroad, we will not have an impact in what we do on, you know, policy preferences like, you know, no impact on the exchange rate. So I think there is a point of no return where you simply, once you open up, you get included in these index, you get drawn into the global economy, and that's where I think you really need to do these supply side reforms to do that in a more resilient manner. So I'm not worried about the sort of credit cycle in China at the moment, because the Chinese central bank can really create a lot more monetary stimulus without even touching interest rates. Reserve requirements are at, you know, 23%, I think is the last number I saw. You can massively reduce reserve requirements for domestic banks and create credit origination without really doing anything through the interest rate channel alone.
Well, this point of no return, opening up, well, the main reason is that opening up is good for China.
Sure.
You know, you mentioned the Asia inclusion into the MSCI index, and the effect that that inclusion is already felt in the Chinese market in terms of raising the quality of the market, because we now have to respond to the demand of the international institutional investors. Mm-hmm. So just to give you a very concrete example, in the Shanghai Stock Exchange, we used to calculate, you know, the closing price of a stock by its last trade. And that's not very good, you know, for international investors. Now, we, according to their request, we have changed that into the average price of the last 3 minutes in a concentrated trading manner. And now it's much better according to the international investors. So this is just a very, you know, small example of how opening up has been good for China, and we'll continue to do that.
The Chinese voice was Fang Jinghai. He's vice chairman of the China Securities Regulatory Commission. And all, then we who chimed in next was Axel A. Weber, chairman of the board and directors of UBS. And that's out of Switzerland, Union Bank of Switzerland. And then Maria Bartiromo was the moderator. And then Ray Dalio chimed in there at one time and did an excellent job in conveying some of the cultural differences of China. But we also, we had he the Chinaman, Fang, started off with a slowdown. And then we went to Weber with 51% ownership now. China's opening up now and allowing 51% or more of foreign companies to own companies there. And then Fang also talked about how the Chinese handle risk. And then Weber came in with point of no return. When you begin to open up your economy to the world, there's no turn back, is what he was saying. So anyway, coming up next, we're going to be talking about some competition in China. With some very, very astute individuals. I'll have some of those names for you after you hear the clip. But here we go with competition in China at the World Economic Forum. Here we go now.
In the next decade, is it inevitable that China is just going to outpace the U.S. in the size of its economy, or we're going to have to learn to live with that? What do you see taking place here going forward and the debate looking like?
Well, I think it's probably inevitable that China outpaces the United States, but will it be 40 years, 400 years? I don't know. I mean, I think that's unclear. And you're absolutely right that in many ways, these very aggressive trade policies don't, the way they're expressed, David said it's not like he's talking Shakespeare, but there's a lot of consensus in Washington. Positions have really hardened around China. Where I think there's a disagreement is, what is it we don't like about it? And President Trump says it's the trade imbalance, which I except for his economic advisor, Peter Navarro, I don't think you could find anyone who agrees with the economists who agrees with that. That's really benign. We're borrowing the money, and that's going to be their tough luck if we don't pay it. But on the other hand, the intellectual property rights, the, you know, forced transfer of intellectual property rights. I mean, these are big issues. And I think something had to happen, because there are certainly people feeling in the United States, we might wake up someday and go, oh no, what have we done?
Are they right to feel that? Or is there just, is there a real concern, or more kind of an unnecessary anxiety that's built up?
I mean, I tend to have a benign view of it, that we in the United States didn't respect Britain's intellectual property rights in the 1800s. And then when we started to be the innovator, suddenly we thought it was a great idea to have intellectual property rights. And I think it's a fair chance we'll see a similar dynamic.
Do you think there's a risk of some broader decoupling, or that the U.S. and China could really disengage in big ways?
Well, I think the mood, my impression of the mood at Davos is that it's somewhat muted, and I think I can't put my finger on why it is, but certainly the concern over the trade war just seeming a lot more real than the rhetoric over globalization that we've heard until now. Nobody's quite sure how bad it will be, how it will play out, what unintended consequences will be. That's certainly something on everybody's mind.
Brian, you wanted to jump in.
I was going to switch the focus of Davos just a hair, but John Kenneth Galbraith, a famous Harvard economist, once said, the conventional wisdom is almost always wrong. So the conventional wisdom in Davos is always X or Y or Z, and it turns out a year later it's almost always wrong, as it was last year. But that's okay. It makes life interesting. Let me just talk about the China situation, what happened. So people who may not have followed as much, maybe just get my perspective. The Chinese government for a long time heard American politicians rail against their various trade practices and intellectual property practices. And then when these people got elected, nothing really got done. So when Trump said these things in the campaign, I don't think the Chinese government took it that much more seriously than when other people had said it. When he came in and actually did some things that they thought he was not likely to do because of the good relationship he had established on a personal rapport with Xi Jinping, they were surprised. They then realized that he was serious and they had to do something about it. They also realized that he represents at least 40 to 45% of the American people, if not more, and that if he were to die tomorrow, whoever his successor would be would likely have similar, if not identical, policies. So they decided they had to do something about it and actually come to an agreement. Their problem was they didn't know who to negotiate with because there were several different negotiators, and they didn't know exactly what President Trump wanted because he hadn't yet defined exactly what he wanted. Now that Bob Lighthizer has been given the mandate to be the principal negotiator, and he's a very skilled negotiator and a very knowledgeable person, he's a special trade representative in the United States, he, I think, is going to bring together a deal, because I think the Chinese really want a deal. They think it's not going to solve all their problems and it's not going to have the Americans be quiet on everything they do in China, but they think a deal will be helpful. And I think the president realizes he's being hurt in some parts of the economy and particularly in the agriculture sector by the tariffs and so forth. So he wants a deal. So I think a deal will get done within the next 2 or 3 months, maybe 4 months.
But even with a deal, we're still going to be engaged for a long time.
Well, forever. In the history of the world, you've never had the two biggest economies always say, hey, we're great friends, we're always going to do things together well. You always have headbutting between the two biggest economies, so nothing is going to go away in that regard.
Stacey, you want to do
I think it's just interesting also.
Coming up next, we have Lagarde talking about climate change on one of the closing panel discussions. But here we go with Lagarde and company right now.
Out whole segments of economies, not to mention the human dramatic damage that it would cause. And we know, for work that we certainly have done at the IMF, that the poorest countries will be the most disproportionately affected by climate change. And we know also, because it's everybody's business, that advanced economies will not be immune. Some industries, we know, will be more affected than others, and some industries will be more instrumental in addressing those issues than others. You would not suspect that, but even central banks and banks have to actually take account of climate change and measure its impact. Insurance companies do too. Kristalina, at the World Bank, you spend a lot of time, effort, and money on those issues of climate change. Can you address some of those concerns and think about policies?
Well, say that climate change is not only happening, it is happening faster than we thought it would. And Stanford University did us a favor to calculate what does it mean if temperatures were to continue to go up, up, up. So they go up to 2.5 degrees. It shapes 15% of the global GDP. It goes up to 3 degrees. We lose 25% of global GDP. And, of course, the cost in terms of suffering is unmeasurable. So what we can do, what we do, and what we can do more of. First, the very obvious, eliminate harmful subsidies. We have done some. We shrunk them by half for nearly 600 billion to now under 300 billion. But we still have $300 billion to go. And I want to praise countries like Egypt that have done the right thing. They had energy subsidies at 7% of GDP. Just imagine, this is more than Egypt spent on education, health and social protection combined. They dropped them to 3%. Egypt has more money to invest in its own people. But also by doing so, the energy sector became attractive for private investments and they went into renewables massively, some 12 to 14 billion. So that is happening. It has to happen faster. And of course, when we do that, we have to be mindful of the impact on poor people. When that is done in that fashion, and I go back to Egypt, we helped Egypt to have social protection policy that reduced the negative impact of energy subsidies removal on poor people. We have to move also in agriculture, where today most of the agricultural subsidies contribute actually to climate change and do not help the energy sector to be part of the new low-carbon economy. Secondly, it is absolutely paramount that we recognize a shift to the new climate economy is great for the economies themselves. We had a commission on the new climate economy. I was very honored to serve on that commission. We came up with a very attractive pathway. We would see $26 billion created in renewable energy, new mobility, low-carbon mobility, low-carbon buildings, and 65 million more jobs as a result. So those who tell you, oh, going to low carbon is really scary and bad for the economy, don't buy it. And then comes the third part of the policy action that in my heart I believe is actually from the perspective of fairness most important. Help countries and communities that have done very little to contribute to climate change but are already living with its consequences, adapt. And I'm thinking here of Niger, Chad, or small island states, or coastal areas in West Africa. It is morally right, but it is also absolutely essential for the sustainability of our world that we lift up action on adaptation. And here is what we have done at the bank.
What I noticed was about, that concludes our program for this evening, but what I began to observe out there was the global warming was being used to sell the rest of their program, and also digital was everywhere. But I want to thank everyone for listening, and I hope that you got some a little insight from what we're doing. But thank you for listening, and good night.